Good morning, everyone. Today is November 12th. Our class in the book of Breshit, Shivim Panim, 70 Faces of Wisdom. The class today is Unit 5 in our curriculum. Unit 5, the Tower of Babel. And of course, the way we'll begin is by reading the appropriate verses in the Torah in the book of Breshit. So as the sheets that I give out to you say, I think they say, we're in Breshit chapter 11, verses 1 to 9. Everyone has one sheet, front and back. We have a quick announcement, okay?
For those of you who weren't in the last class, you can go online today and shop at the JCC fundraiser, and you don't have to attend the event to shop, and it's going to be going on afterwards. And it's got unbelievable items on there, something for everybody. And it is honoring our one and only Yaneko, wherever she is. So, thank you guys, and if you need any information, I'll put it back tomorrow.
Chapter 11, verses 1 to 9. Everyone on earth had the same language and the same words. Chapter 11, verses 1 through 9. Everyone on earth had the same language and the same words. And as they migrated from the east, they came upon a valley in the land of Shinar and settled there. They said to one another, "Come, let us make bricks and burn them hard." Chapter 11, verses 1 to 9. Bricks serve them as stone, and bitumen serve them as mortar. And they said, "Come, let us build us a city and a tower with its top in the sky to make a name for ourselves, else we shall be scattered all over the world." The Lord came down to look at the city and tower that man had built, and the Lord said, "If, as one people, with one language for all, this is how they have begun to act, then nothing that they may propose to do will be out of their reach. Let us then go down and confound their speech there, so that they shall not understand one another's speech." Thus the Lord scattered them from there over the face of the whole earth, and they stopped building the city. That is why it is called Babel, because the Lord there confounded the speech of the whole earth, and from there the Lord scattered them over the face of the whole earth. That's our first reading. Superficial impression. We want to now go back. We're going to read it verse by verse, word by word, and see something about its deeper significance. So we're going back to the first verse. The introduction says, everyone on earth had the same language and the same words. So I want to ask a question about this verse. I sense a difficulty in the verse. And I want to remind you of what I mean when I say a difficulty. A difficulty is not a question. I can ask the question, why is it raining outside? Why are you wearing a blue shirt today? What happened yesterday? Those are questions. To point at a difficulty is something else. To point at a difficulty is to say, why is it raining today? Behold, the weather forecast said it wouldn't rain for the next month. In other words, a difficulty is to point out a contrast, a tension between two matters. I might say, why are you going outside with an umbrella? It's not raining. Or I might say, why did you say X? Behold, you said Y yesterday. Those are examples of a difficulty, not just an open question, but a difficulty. To be technical, a difficulty has a contrast in it, or a tension, or a contradiction. My sainted teacher, Nachum Leibowitz, always used to say that a difficulty can always be phrased with the word behold. Why are you wearing a raincoat? Behold, it's not raining. Why did you say X? Behold, you said Y yesterday. So with that methodological instruction, what difficulty might you find in this first verse? What difficulty? Not just a question, but a difficulty. What bothers you within the verse itself? Anyone?
Same language, same words?
Yeah.
Right.
Exactly. Why is it necessary to say both of those?
Right. Yeah. Or to phrase it in the frank language of difficulty, as my teacher used to tell us, Nachum Leibowitz, you should say, why does it say that everyone on earth with the same words? Behold, you already said they have the same language. Yeah. It seems to be redundant. So therefore, we have to ask ourselves, what is this matter of the same words? Now in Hebrew, the word for words is dvarim. And the word dvarim doesn't just mean words. It's much more expansive. It could mean thoughts. It could mean more than that. I don't want to give it away. But what do you think it means if we already said they have the same language? Now you're telling me they have the same something else.
Could it be that they all have some of the same ideas or goals or aims?
Probably. Right.
So that they're I think part of what this passage is saying is that these people were all acting in concert and in unison for a common purpose.
That could very well be
true.
Right? And indeed, societies have the same language tend to have a certain common culture. In a broad sense, the common way of thinking. In a broad sense. Not necessarily that everyone's saying the same thing, but they're the same language, the same culture, they are the same entity, the same nationality, they're all the same. Now, at the end of the story, we see that the people are scattered. They're not any longer speaking the same language. They're geographically scattered. They're culturally scattered. They're linguistically scattered. This is the story. This is the Torah's way of explaining how the one family that left Noah's Ark, Noah and his wife and his sons and his daughters, how they became into 70 lashon, into 70 languages, 70 people. How did the earth get filled up? According to this story, as we see, they were one language, one family, one clan, and they were scattered against their will. They were punished for something. We have to see what it was. But it's the story of the development of the differentiation that we find in the human race. Here we go. Next verse. And as they migrated from the east, they came upon a valley in the land of Shinar and settled there. So we think of the clan of Noah traveling the earth. In theory, is empty. There's animals. There's no other people there. And they find a valley and they settle there. So we have to ask ourselves, why did they like a valley? Let's ask ourselves, what are the geographical characteristics of a valley? And why would it be comfortable to live in a valley for a clan that is one language and of the same culture? What makes a valley into a valley geographically?
Surrounded
by mountains, right?
Whatever.
So they're basically entering into a closed framework that will keep them together. In the valley, everyone is equal. There's no hills and valleys, but they're on the same level. So it's a plain, but more than a plain, it's surrounded by mountains in some sense. So we're talking about a clan that wants to stay together, is looking for a certain degree of being fenced in, perhaps a certain degree of protection. They want to stay together. We can understand that. They're all alone in the world, as it were. Okay, so they're trying to stay together. Let's go to the next verse. They said one to another, come, let us make bricks and burn them hard. They're going to begin a construction project. The beginning of what we might call technology, of human development, of improving the world. They can have a place to live besides tents, I guess, besides being out in the open. They're going to build houses. And now look at the second half of verse 3. It's like a commentary. Bricks serve them as stone, and bitumen serve them as mortar. So let's examine those words. It seems like stone and mortar is a baseline, is what's expected, but they were able to use brick instead of stone, and bitumen instead of mortar. What is that trying to say? My question is not very well defined. But why is that emphasized, do you think? What's the point of saying that they're building in this method? That they didn't just use stone and mortar, but they used something else. They used brick and bitumen.
Everything is the same?
Everything is the same.
Look the same.
When look the same.
The same size.
Uh-huh.
Stone
okay.
is not.
Okay. Stone is not. Uh-huh. Well, stones, you know, can be carved to the same size. Bricks are made themselves. Stone is carved. It's the natural resources. This is about the development of technology. That they were able to find a way to build even though stone was not available and bitumen was not available. I'm sorry, mortar was not available.
Tar. Bitumen is from tar, I thought, which would have been most likely the natural substance.
Uh-huh.
What it's emphasizing that there's human technology involved in is the bricks.
Right.
Because it's talking about making something and burning them hard and using it in place of stone.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right. Whereas the concept of mortar is just something to glue something together, and it sounds like they used more of a natural substance for that.
Okay, but it's something that apparently is considered to be an advancement.
Right. They took a man-made thing in place of stone that they could make regular, they could make as much as they need of, and they also had the concept there of how to put them together in a way that they would be stable.
Exactly.
To build.
Exactly. Yeah. Bruce and then Myra.
Aren't we making a tremendous assumption of the knowledge that they took onto the ark with them? This is pretty advanced society. This is a pretty advanced state. After we're only on the 11th chapter of Genesis. We're in Genesis.
I always say don't take it literally. Right.
But we are. It's hard to accept.
So don't accept. Don't take it literally.
Okay.
Let's see what the ideas behind the story are.
But on the other hand, we are divine creations. So we are born with all this knowledge.
We are born with all this knowledge. What does that mean?
We're born
not
with
necessarily.
All this knowledge.
I wasn't born with the knowledge of how to make bricks. I think I wasn't.
You were born with certain brain cells that when they mature
can figure it out.
Can learn it.
So okay, that's what Jen was saying. That's the development of human technology. Right? Myra.
Couldn't one also reason be lack of manpower for the stones, to move the stones? You know, aren't they limited on the number of people in this valley, so they had to think of something else.
Perhaps you're right. So it would show that they have the ingenuity to deal with the circumstances they find themselves in, and to build, even though their manpower is lacking, or even though stone is not available, whatever it might be. Usually, from the biblical point of view, stone is quarried from mountains. They're in a valley, might be saying they don't have stone, but nevertheless, their ingenuity allowed them to find a way to build. But what you're saying is also part and parcel, I think, of the same basic direction. Okay, let's go on. Verse 4. And they said, come, let us build a city, and a tower with its top in the sky, to make a name for ourselves, else we shall be scattered over all the world. There seems to be here, at least in our first reading of the verse, means and ends. They have an end, they have a purpose, and towards that purpose they take certain steps. So what is the end and what is the means? In this one verse, means and ends.
Make a name for ourselves would be the... means was the building, but the make a name for ourselves is what the goal was.
Okay, so on one level, it's very possible to read it that they're building a city and a tower with its top in the sky in order to, for the purpose of, for the end of, to make a name for ourselves.
But on another, what that means.
But on another level, there's another level means an ends here. Is it? What else?
Not to be scattered.
It seems the ultimate goal is not to be scattered.
But my question then is, why would they anticipate that they would be scattered?
Thank you for asking that question. Why would they anticipate being scattered? Is there any force here that is scattering them? What's going on? Why are they afraid of it?
They did just get off an ark.
No.
They got off the ark. They're one family. They speak the same language. They have one culture. And why are they afraid of being scattered? That really has to give us pause. Why are they afraid of being scattered? So, let's think. If this is a story about the development of human society, the development of civilization, the development of technology, and we're not taking it literally, this is not something that happens in 1 year or 5 years, this is, think of a broad picture, why would they be afraid of being scattered? Any ideas?
Well, being on the ark showed them the enormity of the world.
A lot of world out there.
Fear mm-hmm. of destruction and the need to be together.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but why? I can understand the fear of wild animals coming and killing them, but what about being scattered? Two people.
In the previous chapter, it said that they disperse the descendants.
Oh, that's a very good point. Yeah. That's a very good point.
They are no longer this one little.
Okay, so here we have to say, and this gets into things I've mentioned in the past, in a certain sense, chapter 10 and chapter 11 are what I call shtei bichinot, two aspects, two different ways of looking at the development of human society. Chapter 10 talks about a natural development into different nations. Chapter 11 talks about some type of divine intervention that caused this development into different languages, different cultures. It's probably something like chapter 1 and chapter 2 of Sefer Bereshit, two different aspects of looking at the meaning of the separation of human cultures. Chapter 11 is a different, I think, aspect than chapter 10. That's a good point. Yes?
When you have the mindset of developing technology, it's counterproductive for that to be scattered.
Right, you want to have everyone together.
It's disturbing the equilibrium.
To pool your minds. It's very good.
Yeah, now
that would seem to be something different. I want to bring up... Jen?
Well, I'm just wondering if, considering their experience right after they left the Ark, and the curses that were placed on Ham's descendants and everything, I'm wondering if there's some type of a... they can see being at counter purposes and conflicts and see and have a worry about their behaviors causing them to have conflicts and then causing mm-hmm. dispersion. But I'm not quite sure how to balance that with this goal of making a name for ourselves.
Okay.
Because it's not real sure. It's not real clear to me what that means.
Okay. I'd like to build upon that. It could be, and this is just a theory, trying to, as far as possible, stay within the meaning of the words and not add extraneous material, but we have to ask ourselves why they're afraid to be scattered. So perhaps we have something that's very natural, which is conflicting visions. There are those people that want to stay together, perhaps the majority, perhaps the leaders, but there are apparently forces here within themselves that are pushing for decentralization, pushing for individuality, right? Perhaps forces that have conflict in mind. It doesn't have to be pejorative like Jan said. It could be simply individuals who want to break away from the group and go out on their own. And there's a little bit of conflict developing here. So if we think of the people, the majority or the leaders, who are afraid of this diversification, afraid of the individuals, the bohemians, those who are thinking different, who want to scatter. They want to keep the whole group together. So they have a means here to try and develop, I would say, national pride, to keep the collective together. Come, let us build a city. It's going to keep people together. It's going to improve our lives. It's going to be a source of pride. Look what we can build. We'll build a tower that's top in the sky. Everyone will see our great technology. We'll make a name for ourselves. We'll be famous, and we will instill national pride in the group. We'll help the group stay together. So it could be what's happening here. There's a certain centrifugal force that's pulling people separate for the reasons we mentioned, and the majority of the leaders are trying to keep us together through the pride that's engendered by technology. Now, let's just think a minute about this matter of name for ourselves.
To whom?
Okay.
The only group.
To ourselves. For ourselves. We want everyone to be able to look at this tower and say, wow, look what we built. We're good. We're the leading nation on the earth. And certainly no other nations. But it inspires perhaps pride. And that's good. To keep us together. But someone said, like?
Jerry Jones.
Who built the Cowboy Stadium.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll actually get to that. We can get to that. We can very much get to that. Okay. Let me think now. Let's look at something I gave you at the top of the sheet, Bereishit 12, chapter 8. Bereishit 12, chapter 8. It's just a page later. Abraham, when he's told by God to leave the land that he was born in and go out to a new land, Canaan, to make a new nation, it says in chapter 12, verse 8, from there he moved on to the hill country. Abraham got to the land of Canaan, east of Beit El, and pitched his tent, and Beit El on the west, and Ai in the east, and he built there an altar to the Lord and invoked the Lord by name. He called on the name of the Lord. Abraham, again and again the Torah says, I think it's three times, that he built an altar and called the name of the Lord. And I compare that to the men and women of the door of the dispersion that built a tower to call on their own name. There's a contrast here. It's a clear contrast. Abraham calls on God's name with a low structure. The people of the generation of the dispersion build a high tower to call on their own name. So we just about said it with Jerry Jones, but the word we're looking for is something beyond pride. It's arrogance, right? It's a certain vanity. You're saying perhaps more than vanity. I don't know. So I want to hear... work with a nuance of thought. Unity, good and bad. Technology, good and bad. That's what I want to talk about in the next 5 minutes. I think that there's a play here in the verses of the destruction of the door, I'm sorry, of the dispersion of the generation of the tower, where we're dealing with the nuances for good and for bad of two different concepts. One is unity and one is technology. Let's talk about unity. Obviously, unity is a very, very positive value. As Jews, we're always talking about the need for unity, and we're always talking about the issues that we have in our divided community, different synagogues and different streams of Judaism and unaffiliated and affiliated and reform, conservative. We all know that we strive for unity. And the same thing in the world, the United Nations, the same thing in the U.S. We're always looking to get over our differences. People are talking about a lot now with the election of Obama. Unity is a very positive value. And it's very good that the people of this generation wanted to stay together. However, perhaps there is also, and every good idea has a black lining, right? There's something very negative in unity. Unity stifles diversity, stifles creativity, right? Stifles the development of different ideas. It turns into sometimes totalitarianism. Let's think now about technology. That's another theme here. Technology is a good thing. Advance the world. Make life a better place. We learned already in Bereshit chapter 1, verse 27 to 30, we were commanded to be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth, world and conquer it. Technology is a positive thing. Of course it is. Medicine, building techniques, sanitation, mass communication, it's all good. Is it all good? Wait a second. There's a downside to technology. Technology can lead to pride, to vanity, to extravagance, to materialism, and that could lead us further, both, by the way, both the excess of unity, which is totalitarianism, and the excess of technology, which is pride and materialism, both of them can lead us away from appreciating the human spirit, the human individual, towards an overbearing societal emphasis on building, on pride, on construction, and you lose sight of the spirit, of the soul, of the connection to a higher meaning, and you lose sight of the individual. And it could be that we have to go back to our verses and look at these nuances here. Because there are good things that they are doing, but they're turning into bad. They're looking for unity and they're looking for technology, and that's good. But it goes too far. The unity perhaps turns into a certain type of totalitarianism, in which they won't let those people who want to scatter, scatter. And the technology turns into, let's make a name for ourselves, and it's all about us. I'm reminded of a Hasidic story which I might have told you once. Perhaps I didn't. Anyone know? There's a Hasidic story that says that a person should always walk around with a note in each of his two front pockets. And if you want the back pockets, that's good also. Right? One pocket is a note that says, Bishvili nivra haolam. For me, the world was created. Another pocket is a note that says, Anuhi afar ve'efer. I am nothing but dust and ashes. And the idea is that they're both true. They have to balance each other. At different times in my life, I might have different needs. If I'm down in the dumps, if I have no self-confidence, I don't understand what my purpose in life is, in the world, I want to stick my hand in that pocket that says, for me, the world was created. Every individual is worth, and God wants me to express myself and my talents and do something. It's true, the world was created for me. But there are other times in life which I'm stuck up, I'm always concerned with myself, I think I'm the most important thing. I have to put my hand in the other pocket that says, Anuhi afar away from nothing but dust and ashes. Remember that, who are you? You're nothing. That's what's going on here, perhaps. It's good to remember the world was created for me, but there's a limit. And when it becomes, I'll make a name for myself, and our whole society is about self-aggrandizement, then perhaps it's gone too far. And like we said earlier, the other aspect as well, the unity here is an important thing, but when it becomes, if it is becoming a matter of stifling the creativity of the individuals, then perhaps we have a problem. And we have a problem, and they're punished. They're punished for something. So it's what they're punished for, I would think, is either the unity that turns into totalitarianism, or the technology that turns into the self-aggrandizement in which man thinks he's the measure of all things. I'll just tell you a short story that I read about a few months ago. This goes back to the 1950s to the Harvard Philosophy Department. The story goes that a donor donated a new building. And at the end of the spring semester, before they went for summer break, the professors decided what inscription to put on the new building. And they decided, I think it's on Protagoras, I think he's the one that said, man is the measure of all things. That would be the inscription on the building. They go for summer break, they come back, and they find the inscription on the building is, who is man that thou shalt be mindful of him? The president of Harvard changed the inscription. Right? Because perhaps man is not the measure of all things. The other side of it is, who is man that you should be mindful of him? A speck of dust. So anyway, perhaps that tension is going on here. Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay, so let's see. Yes?
Well, wouldn't you think, like, if you were chosen to survive this immense flood and be the only survivors, you kind of are...
That's a good point.
Kind of do have a big ego there. I mean, you know,
that's
why
true.
Me? And,
wow, that's a very good point.
Special.
I didn't think of that. Yeah?
Yeah.
Can't help but think that.
You can't help but think that, but it's dangerous.
Right.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Mm-hmm. Let's go on in reading the verses. Let's look at verse 5. The Lord came down to look at the city and the tower that man had made, and the Lord said, if as one people with one language for all, this is how they've begun to act, then nothing that they may propose to do will be out of their reach. So God is concerned that in this situation of unity, they are doing something that's bad. It doesn't say what, and it might go too far. And we're left to ask, what is it? And we already suggested, either it's the technology that's turning into self-aggrandizement and materialism and patting themselves on the back and thinking man is the measure of all things. Perhaps it's the unity that's turning into totalitarianism. But whatever it is, it doesn't say. We're left to guess. Perhaps it's both. God is concerned, more than concerned, that things have gone wrong. Let us, then, go down, remind us of the beginning of Bereshit, when God talks in the plural, let us create man in our image. So it's let us then go down and confound their speech there, so that they shall not understand.
Where are
verse
7.
Verse
7, chapter
11.
Page 17.
Chapter 11, verse 7. Yeah. Let us then go down and confound their speech there so that they shall not understand one another's speech. And the unity, which is essentially a positive value, because somehow in some sense it led to these negatives, whether again it's the technology that has become overbearing pride, or whether it's the unity that's become totalitarianism, unity has turned out to be a two-edged sword, and it has to be destroyed. Thus the Lord scattered them from there over the face of the whole earth, and they stopped building the city. This is why it is called Bavel. The word Bavel in Hebrew means mixed up. But we call it the Tower of Bavel because it caused them to become mixed up, because there the Lord confounded and mixed up the speech of the whole earth. In other words, in Hebrew it says it's called Bavel because God baveled them. It's called confounded because God confounded them. God confounded the speech of the whole earth, and from there the Lord scattered them over the face of the whole earth. So they are geographically scattered, and they are linguistically, culturally scattered. Because, again, something went wrong with these very positive values. They went wrong. That's a framework. Now we can start examining. I thought to go right now to the curriculum. There are some very interesting commentaries here. But yesterday, I was sitting for a few minutes in the library here on the top floor in the Mankoff Education Center. I had a few minutes. I took a book off the shelf. It was the commentary on the book of Genesis published for the Reform Movement and written by Plant. Anyone know?
Plant.
And I was so taken by some of the comments in the back of the book that I photostated them and I prepared them for the sheets for you. So let's look now at what I brought here. I hope we do get to the curriculum because I'm being paid to teach their curriculum. But what can I do?
We will
teach it.
So the first one is from Arthur Kutzler. I don't remember who he is. Anyone know who he is? Don't remember. Okay.
A writer?
Yeah, the name is familiar. It's on the first sheet, right?
Do you have any more though?
Do I have any more?
Here,
can you do that for me? Language promotes communication and understanding within the group, but it also accentuates the differences in traditions and beliefs between groups. It erects barriers between tribes, nations, regions, and social classes. It's simple. In other words, the group that has the same language is kept cohesively together. But that togetherness divides us from others who have a different language. I'm going to skip the next sentence for a moment and go to the third sentence. According to Margaret Mead, among the 2 million aborigines in New Guinea, 750 different languages spoken in 750 different villages, which are at permanent war with each other. So I just brought this source to remind us of what's obviously true, that linguistic unity is, in theory, a very, very, very positive thing. Very positive thing.
There was a story in yesterday's New York Times about a primitive society today, where in each village, they still, one village doesn't know what the next village is saying.
Mm-hmm.
They can't understand each other. Mm. And they have remained very primitive because of that reason.
Mm-hmm. Now the second sentence that I skipped. The Tower of Babel is an, I guess I left out a word, archetypical symbol of the process which turns the blessing into a curse and prevents man from reaching into heaven. I gave this sentence a bit of thought. I think he means the following. Reaching into heaven, he's taking a positive sense. Man, when he's unified linguistically, can reach into heaven. I guess he means it in a sense different than in the verses. In the verses, it's in a negative sense, but he means it to reach higher levels of technology, of understanding, of unity for the good of man. That's fine. But in our story, there's a process that turns the blessing of unity into a curse. And he doesn't say how that happens. He's not telling us. He's just talking about the goodness of unity. We have to go back to the verses and see what we talked about in the past half an hour. Why did this blessing go wrong? Was it that unity turned into totalitarianism? Was it that technology turned into overbearing pride? Whatever it is, I just brought this source to remind us that unity is a positive thing, but it can go bad. It's all about nuance. You know that's my personality. It's always about nuance, right? Now, Cyrus Gordon, I do remember a little bit who he was. I think was an archaeologist who taught at Harvard, I think. This goes back a number of years, 30, 40 years. It is possible that the reports of all the earth having one language, in Genesis, what we just read, have a historical foundation. The coexistence of one lingua franca, did I pronounce that right?
Yes.
And many national tongues is attested at various stages of history. Greek, Latin, French, and English have at certain times served as the one language of many people. And such coexistence reported also of the pre-Columbian Central America. Again, just saying that language, it is possible that there are linguistic commonalities that keep people together. The loss of a means of international communication must at all times be the prelude to international strife. Again, telling us unity is an important value. Now look at this midrash. Midrash HaGadol is a midrashic collection that probably is very, very late, probably from the 9th, 10th, 11th centuries in Yemen. But it records midrashic traditions that are perhaps 1,000 years older. Why was the generation of the flood destroyed, right, Noah's flood, while that of Babel was merely dispersed? Why was one generation so much worse than the other? Why was generation dispersion, not so bad. They didn't get death, they only got dispersion. The Babylonians, that is to say, the builders of the tower, said one to the other, come, let us build. They worked together in peace and harmony. This distinguished them from the people of the flood who committed violence against one another and were therefore destroyed. The generation of the tower defied God openly. He doesn't define what the crime was. Yet because they practiced brotherhood towards each other, they were merely scattered. As there's something good in their bad. It's a goal of that nuance. We still have to put our fingers on what the bad was, but we should not deny that unity is a positive value. Of course, brotherhood, fraternity, let us never learn from this chapter that unity is only bad. Of course it's not. Right? But there's nuance. Let's read another one. This one I really like, because it gets us into now talking of actually what was the crime. What is this rebellion against God? So look at this. Rav Avadya ben Yaakov Sporno is one of the classic commentators on the Torah. The real crime of the builders was that they tried to impose one religion upon mankind. God prevented this and by dispersing the peoples kept alive a variety of idolatries. But he knew that out of this diversity would eventually come a recognition of the supreme ruler. That is so powerful. Mm-hmm. Unity, of course, is a positive value, but think of the downside of unity. Even if you don't talk about governmental totalitarianism, but you have cultural totalitarianism, if we all speak the same language, live in the same place, same culture, there is a stifling of creative thought. And perhaps not purposely, or perhaps purposely, it tends to prevent people from expressing their personalities and their understanding and their new insights. And therefore, if they're going to become stuck in a rut, and the society is going to depreciate and degenerate, there has to be a certain degree of freedom. And there can't be that degree of freedom if everyone speaks the same language, the same culture, to develop new ideas. And we're willing, according to the Sforno, we're willing to talk about freedom, talk about different idolatries in order to allow for the religious diversity that will bring with it the advancements towards monotheism. I think that's just such a deep idea, how ghettoization, and we can apply it to our generation, prevents religion and other important things from developing. There has to be a certain degree of diversity, of autonomy. So again, this, I love this source. Just unity is a good thing, but it has something negative to it. Has something bad to it. And here, I guess God felt that the bad outweighed the good. And even and they had to pay the price of being scattered with all of the conflict and all of the war that's engendered by being scattered into different cultures that don't understand each other. But the good side of it is that there is freedom to think. The next source is from the Apocalypse of Baruch, which is a book written by Jews, for Jews, and about Jews in the 200 years before the Common Era. But it didn't enter the mainstream of Jewish literature. It's what we call in Hebrew the Sfarim HaChitzonim, the external books. It's what academicians call the pseudo-epigrapha, and it's what the Protestants and Catholics call the apocrypha. Basically the same books. It says, they drove forth multitudes of both men and women to make bricks. It sounds like we're talking about a totalitarian society that is fixed gung-ho on building that building.
At all costs.
Among whom a woman making bricks was not allowed to be released in the hour of childbirth, because it was so important to build the building, but had to give birth while she was making bricks, and carried her child in her apron and continued to make bricks. It's a story, right? It's a fable, but what's the idea behind it?
It's so extreme, and it's losing sight of values of human life, all for the sake of this technology and this so-called goal.
Right. Technology is a good thing, but it's a good thing that can go bad. Technology should be for the purpose of improving human life, but technology can become an end instead of a means. And then the technology is more important than the people. And getting to space or building the tallest building in the world become ends in their ends, and we lose human value of life. We lose spirituality. Materialism takes the place of human beings.
And the tower becomes an idol?
The tower becomes an idol. Thank you.
Oh, yes.
Oh, you have two gold stars today. I'm going to try to remember the things that you said. The first thing you said was... Right, well, I can't remember. But the first thing you said today was... No, Myra, what was the first thing? I wanted to remember it. You said something about... Oh, the ego, right. Okay, right. Yeah.
I'm inspired by my husband.
Ah. Oh, look at that. Okay. But that inspires you? Midrash HaGadol. As the tower grew in height, it took a full year to get bricks from the base to the upper stories. An exaggeration, but it's making a point. Thus, bricks became more precious than human life. When a brick slipped and fell, the people wept. But when a man fell and died, no one paid attention.
Time of the pharaohs.
Lost their humanity.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there are many of us who say when the building committee decides to go up another three stories, the content in the synagogue goes down.
That's a very, in my opinion, that's a very true statement.
Yeah. That, you know what? It's tied to this.
That's right.
One more quote. John Ruskin, never heard of him, lectures on architecture and painting, quote in Solomon Goldman in the beginning, JPS 1949. From that day to this, it means from the day of the Tower of Babel until our day, whenever men have become skillful architects at all, there has been a tendency in them to build high. Not in any religious feeling, that was not for a positive reason, but in a mere exuberance of spirit and power. As they dance or sin, with a certain mingling of vanity, like the feeling in which a child builds a tower of cards.
Gotta build that building taller.
And I can't but think of what some say is and was the Muslim reaction to the Twin Towers.
Then they blew up the wrong buildings, please. There's buildings all over this world that are taller than that.
Okay.
They're going after a people, not a building.
Obviously, I'm not here to justify terrorism. Please, right? Sure,
I know you're not.
But let's just think what those buildings and others like them symbolized to the disenfranchised of the third world. In some sense, on some level, they saw those buildings as a symbol of American arrogance, pride, taking over the world, trying to make the world into one language, right? One language, one McDonald's, one all of the other franchises, and they feel themselves being attacked.
They could have stayed in Dubai.
And they're
a lot more rich.
Right, they're challenging us, right, with a taller building. But in any case, what we want to try and do, if our material is to be meaningful, is to try and see what it means to us. Is there in our society any of the black linings to the silver clouds that we ourselves are guilty of? We're a society of technology. Do we sometimes go too far? We're a society of striving for unity. Does that unity sometimes stifle individual thought?
I think the something good that's coming out of it is the green revolution, the saving of the land, the saving of...
Right, the technology has to be...
Technology is not the end.
Right, it's not the be-all and the end-all. There's other values that can and should temper it for 100%.
What happens in our world today when, for example, one language becomes the common language? There was a little squib that went by actually in the New York Times about 10 days ago. Within the next 5 years, the largest English-speaking country in the world will be China.
Yeah. I think that it's all about balance, right? We hope there's a way to grab on to and utilize the positive sides of unity of a common language as far as international understanding and brotherhood. At the same time, have local languages that allow for individual creativity, for national expression. Our goal is always, in my opinion, my understanding of Jewish ethics, is always to hold the stick by both ends, to balance between two values that are both important, but they're contradictory. Right? It's everything we're saying in the book of Deuteronomy, everything we're saying here. Unity on the one hand, I don't have to say it again, we've said it, right? It's about balance. And the story we're reading, I think, is a matter of good gone amok, you say in English?
Yeah.
Gone amok. Because of the preponderance of one direction, which stifles the other direction. technology, like we said, becomes overbearing pride and materialism. Unity becomes overbearing totalitarianism, stifling creativity. So we'll have time, I think, perhaps for only one of the sources from the curriculum. I'll choose the one that I think is closest to the simple meaning of the text. I hope you'll have time to see the others at home. The one I'd like to see is number... Kasuto Commentary 2, Student Reader, pages 78 to 80. Professor Umberto Kasuto was a fascinating character. It is page 77 in the reader. You can see that he was an Italian Bible scholar, chief rabbi of Florence from 1914 to 1925, moved to Israel in 1938, and continued his academic career at the Hebrew University. He was one of the first professors of Bible at Hebrew University. And approximately the same time that he joined the faculty of Hebrew University, my teacher and mentor, Nahama Leibowitz, made Aliyah from Germany to Jerusalem, to Israel. She was a very close friend and colleague of hers. He died, as you can see, 1951. She died 30 years later. So when I knew her, in the last 10 years of her life, she constantly talked about him. Had been good friends as if he was still alive, and I feel almost as if I met him through her. And he writes the following in his commentary on Genesis. Despite the fact that the background of the story is Mesopotamian, there is no parallel to it in the Mesopotamian writings, as there is to the accounts of the creation and the flood and to many other matters in the early sections of the book of Genesis. Some scholars have, it is true, suggested that the narrative represents a redaction of Mesopotamian material, but this view is pure conjecture. So let me just tell you that scholars of comparative literature have discovered that both in the sphere of Agadah and in the sphere of Halakha, I'll explain what I mean, there are parallels between the Bible and Ugaritic, Sumerian, Assyrian literature. They have a flood story like we have a flood story. They have a creation story like we have it. And there are similarities. But many scholars point out, I'll add another famous scholar, Yechezkel Kaufman, that deals with this, who also taught at Hebrew University in the previous century, that by comparing biblical literature with contemporaneous non-Jewish literature, sure, by seeing the differences that stand out, among the similarities, you see the specific point that the Bible is trying to make. The same thing goes in halakhic literature. There are many laws in the book of Exodus that are parallel, have parallels in the Code of Hammurabi from about the same time. But we see the subtle differences the Torah emphasized, and that tells us the unique values the Torah is trying to change compared to what was in vogue at that time. But in our story of the dispersion, says Professor Kasuto, there is no parallel story that we can compare it to. It's missing. Why? Because he claims, as he's about to say, this story that we're reading is a complete, it's a satire of Babylonian values and culture. There is no parallel story that we're making a little change in. It's two different worldviews. We'll read on. But there is no need for conjectures, nor should it cause surprise that our story lacks parallels. It is impossible for such parallels to be found among the neighboring nations, since the narrative is essentially a protest against the concepts and ideas of these peoples. There is no question here of partial opposition restricted to given points. In other words, similarity and some differences. No. Such as we observed in the previous sections, in the creation story, in the flood story, rather the entire theme as a counterblast. This is not merely a new Israeli recension, a redaction of the traditional materials of the ancient East in keeping with Israel's ethos. It represents, rather, a polarically opposite attitude to that of the pagan peoples. We have before us a kind of satire and what appeared to be a thing of beauty and glory in the eyes of the Babylonians, a parody of their customary assertions and narrations. And it's a satire on their propensity to feel great glory in their building projects and to feel a great importance in their unity, as we'll see. The possibility of parallels existing in Babylonian literature is thus excluded. When the Babylonian temple and its tower were first erected, in other words, we know where the Tower of Babel was, and it still exists today. There's a picture at the bottom of the page. And we'll read on. when the Babylonian tower and its tower were first built, we do not know for certain. Apparently they were erected in the period of Hammurabi, 18th to 17th centuries BC, long before the Bible. So proud and boastful of their splendid buildings were the Babylonians of that period that they attributed them to the gods. Of the high tower, only the merest fragment, a portion of the lowest story, remains. And even this was buried beneath heaps of debris until the expedition of, who knows German? Thank you. Which excavated the ruins of Babylon in 1889 to 1917 and uncovered it. Even this relic tends to leave on the observer an amazing impression of a colossal structure. Not without reason was the Tower of Babylon regarded as one of the wonders of the world. Notice in ancient literature it says this is one of the wonders of the world. You can go and see it 3,000 years ago. There can be no doubt that the biblical story refers specifically to the city of Babylon and to the Ziggurat Etemenamanki. A ziggurat is a tower. It is expressly stated in the Bible, therefore its name, it is the name of the city mentioned at the end of the preceding verse, was called Babel, which is Babylon. And there was a country called Babylon. It was a tower called the Tower of Babylon. And it was destroyed. Not just according to the Bible, we know it's destroyed because it's no longer standing. And it is that destruction is attested to in Babylonian literature. This destruction took place in the middle of the 16th century BCE, and several centuries passed before they began to rebuild the city. Needless to say, during that period, the children of Israel remembered the vainglorious bragging of the Babylonians with derision. And it is probable that at this period, the Israelites composed satiric poems on the building of the city and its tower. You, children of Babylon, in this or similar vein ran the thoughts of the Israelites. You called your city Babel. That's how you say it in Babylonian. And what it is Babila, gate of the gods, what it's mean. Or Babylana, gate of the gods. And your tower you designated house of the foundation of heaven and earth. Babylon means tower of the gods. You desired that the top of your tower should be in heaven. Expressions of this kind are actually found in the Babylonian inscriptions in regard to the structure of the tower. And you did not know that God alone, not a human being, can determine where the gate of God is. Nor did you realize that the heavens are the heavens of the Lord, and only the earth hath he given to the children of man. So in the commentary, in the understanding of Professor Casuto, the problem was that technology turned into this vainglorious preening position that says man is the measure of all things. Man can do anything. There's no limits to man's power. There's no place for moderation, and there's no place for humility. It's hubris. That was the sin according to Professor Casuto. We saw in the verses there's a strong basis to understand like that. And all the more so, remember that they call this Babel in their language gate of the gods. As if they're reaching up to the gods. You did not understand, says Professor Casuto, that even if you were raised to the summit of your ziggurat, ever so high, you would not be nearer to him than when he stood upon the ground, than when he sat upon the ground. Nor did you comprehend that he who in truth dwells in heaven, if he wishes to take a close look at your lofty tower, must needs come down. That's the point we didn't emphasize. The verse says God came down to look. According to Professor Casuto, that means to emphasize that as high as that tower was, it wasn't close at all to God. It wasn't the tower of the gods at all, as they thought it was. You did not consider, says Professor Casuto, the fact that you lack strong and durable material. The nature of your country compels you to use bricks for stone, asphalt for mortar, and hence you could not hope that your buildings would long endure. So he's understanding the matter of bricks and mortar in a fashion different than the way I explained it. That it comes to emphasize that their building materials were actually very, very flimsy. I'm not sure I would agree with that, but that doesn't really matter. Your intention was to build for yourselves a gigantic city that would contain all mankind. And you forgot that it was God's will to fill the whole earth with human settlements. That God's plan would surely be realized. And he accuses them of trying to frustrate the divine commandment to fill the earth, because they wanted to stay together. So he's putting another sin into their coffin that we didn't emphasize, and I didn't see that emphasized in the text. take it or leave it. Now you have ceased building your city, and it lies in desolation and ruins. And the ziggurat that you built in its midst is only rubble. You were proud of your power, but you should have known that it is forbidden to man to exalt himself. For only the Lord is truly exalted, and the pride of man is regarded by him as iniquity that leads to his downfall and degradation of punishment befitting the crime. By the way, it's often said that you really don't need God to punish pride and vainglory because it always punishes itself, right? Societies that become too full of themselves ultimately find their demise. For this reason, your city, which you wish to make into unified and unique center for all the peoples of the world, a city in which all tongues were spoken, I don't understand why he says all tongues are spoken, because we read they had only one tongue, lies in ruins. On account of this, your dominion was shattered and your families were scattered over the face of the whole earth. Behold, how fitting is the name that you gave to your city. And Professor Kasuto says that sarcastically. It is true that in your language it expresses glory and pride, right, the gate of the gods. But in our language, in Hebrew, Babel means scattered. But in our idiom, it sounds as though it connotes confusion, the confusion of tongues heard therein, which causes destruction and the dispersion of its inhabitants in every direction. In other words, the Torah is making a parody on the meaning of the word in Babylonian. Babylonian means gate of the gods, but the Torah understands that word as if it was a Hebrew root meaning dispersion. That any type of effort to build a tower up to heaven, that vainglorious arrogance ultimately will lead to destruction and dispersion. Okay. Food for thought.
I can only see something in here about